Good evening and welcome to the local news. I am April Lewis, reporting for KMUD from our studios in South Humboldt. Before tonight's news, I'd like to bring up KMUD's Spring Drive. Please support KMUD during our Spring Membership Drive April 13th to the 22nd. Your donation helps us broaden our programming and keep you up to date with the local news. Go to kmud.org or call in at 707-923-3911. You can also send a check or cash to our mailbox. It's P.O. Box 135 in Redway, zip code 95560. Again, that's P.O. Box 135 in Redway. We'd really appreciate any amount you can give. Every day it costs $1,600 to run the station. That's $66 every hour, or about a dollar per minute. Our CPB funding is not coming back anytime soon, as the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has officially dissolved. And now our members account for about one quarter of our funding. To keep our news broadcast going, we need your help. Again, you can call 707-923-3911 or kmud.org to donate. I'd like to emphasize that without this funding, without your donations, we will struggle to maintain emergency and breaking news coverage we have brought you in the past, and that includes fire warnings. That includes coverage in North Mendocino and areas of South Humboldt with elevated fire risk, especially in this dry year. As news director, I would like nothing more than to bring you the most comprehensive, accurate, and up-to-date emergency coverage possible. But we need the staff and resources to make it happen. Please help us as we continue to provide this essential service. Please donate. The membership drive will be this month, from the 13th to the 22nd. We appreciate all of you who have given your money and time to help KMUD. And now to the newscast. We'll start with a rundown of today's top stories, followed by reporting from our news team. On this broadcast, we have stories on Assemblymember Chris Rogers' town hall in Garberville and an update on Rick Toledo, along with additional stories. Welcome to the rundown. Starting off with breaking and continuing news from the Middle East. Today marks a serious turning point in the Iran conflict, and the situation is still developing and ongoing. We will be bringing you our most up-to-date information as of press time. However, please note that new information is constantly pouring in. We will update you with each newscast on the situation in Iran until things are more settled in the region. In a notable development, President Trump stated that, quote, "A whole civilization will die tonight," end quote, a notable escalation of his rhetoric. According to the Associated Press, the United States, in direct coordination with Israel, has struck the Iranian oil hub of Karg Island. Trump issued an ultimatum for Iran to capitulate by 8 p.m. Eastern on Tuesday, and is threatening to blow up every bridge, power plant, and railway in Iran. As of this broadcast, Israeli warplanes have already started to attack bridges and railways. The AP reported that 18 people have died and 24 injured already during a strike in Iran's Alborz province, which is northwest of Tehran. The response in Iran has been intense. The Iranian president has stated that 14 million Iranians have volunteered to sacrifice their lives to protect the country. According to reporting from The Guardian, Iranian state media has displayed video and images of people gathering around bridges and power stations ahead of a major U.S. attack. This situation is live, dire, and constantly changing. We will continue to bring you updates as this impacts our region's economy and the greater world. It is important to note that attacks on civilian infrastructure are considered war crimes and are strictly prohibited under the Geneva Convention. Impacts of the Iran war are already being immediately felt in Europe, and according to Reuters, 18% of French petroleum stations are already facing outright shortages. Perhaps the largest immediate impact to our local community is the fertilizer pricing crisis, with approximately one-third of the world's fertilizer supplies usually passing through the Strait of Hormuz. According to reporting by PBS, fertilizer is now 40% more expensive than before the conflict 2 months ago, and prices are expected to climb. This could result in far higher food prices than we are already seeing across the Emerald Triangle's grocery stores and food markets. Increased fuel prices also contribute greatly to higher costs for all goods. One of the great things about our region is the sheer number and enthusiasm of the North Coast farmers markets. As food prices climb out of control, it is a great time to keep things local and support our local farmers and craft food merchants. Pricing for local food from our farmers markets is likely to end up being cheaper than traditional retailers this summer with the current fertilizer and fuel price crisis. The Arcata Plaza Farmers Market is back to its summer hours, which are 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. every Saturday. South Humboldt Farmers Markets in Shelter Cove and Miranda will be opening back up in May, as will Garberville's. The Dockside Market in Eureka for locally caught seafood will be back in June. There are many more farmers markets to visit, and a North Coast Growers Association website is an excellent resource for which markets to check out. You can also reach out to many of our growers and craft merchants for direct sales from family farms. We want to stand by you and your families during this difficult time, and we'll keep you informed as resources become available. And now to in-depth reporting from our news team. First with Nat Cardos with an update on Rick Toledo.
An update on the case against Rick Toledo, the student activist in Arcata that was arrested following a February 27th sit-in protest on campus at Cal Poly Humboldt. The misdemeanor criminal complaint was filed on April 2nd, signed by District Attorney Stacey Eads, and lists three counts: false imprisonment, Penal Code 236, assault, Penal Code 240, and battery, Penal Code 242. All three complaints name Cal Poly faculty member Michael Gordon Moore Jr. as the alleged victim. Originally, Toledo was arrested on four criminal allegations, the fourth being conspiracy to commit a crime. All charges currently filed are considered wobblers, meaning that the prosecutor could charge it as a misdemeanor or a felony. The conspiracy charge, Penal Code 182A1, which was recommended by the university police at booking, is not on the complaint. It's possible that the DA is still reviewing the electronics seized from Toledo from a search warrant served on March 19th. Additionally, it may present a hurdle to charge Toledo with the conspiracy charge, as he is the only protester arrested in connection with the February 27th protest. The civil workplace violence restraining order that was filed against Toledo by Samuel Kinn of the California Attorney General's Office on behalf of Cal Poly Humboldt and faculty member Moore on March 3rd was dropped before the complaint was filed without a contested hearing. Toledo is scheduled to have an arraignment hearing at the Humboldt County Superior Courthouse on April 20th at 1:30 p.m. This is still a developing story, and KMA News will provide further information as it becomes available.
And now, information from a press release from the Shasta Trinity National Forest Service. Spring mushroom harvest season is open on the Mount Shasta and McCloud Ranger districts of the Shasta Trinity National Forest and runs through July 31st, 2026. While many outdoor enthusiasts take to the forest in spring to enjoy wildflowers, hunt, or fish, some venture out in search of wild mushrooms. Wild mushrooms typically grow under the cover of leaves, dead wood, and other forest debris, quickly emerging after moderate or heavy rain. Forest visitors new to harvesting mushrooms should learn how to differentiate between edible and poisonous varieties. Some mushrooms show similar characteristics. Go with someone well-versed in these differences. Harvesting for personal use is free, and commercial use permits may be purchased by anyone 18 years or older. Please note, do not rake ground litter. It destroys the mushroom beds and takes a long time for them to recover. Also, please be courteous to other pickers, packing out what garbage you pack in. Be light on the land, especially when roadways and trails are wet and muddy. Use caution when traveling on forest system roads. Watch for fallen trees and road surface damage and overhead hazards when walking through the woods. For more information about safe types of mushrooms and safe harvesting methods, contact the McCloud or Mount Shasta Ranger stations. I'm April Lewis for KMUD News. And now, highlights focusing on healthcare issues from the Chris Rogers Town Hall in Garberville.
On Saturday, April 4th, 2nd District Assembly member Chris Rogers held a town hall meeting in Garberville in what used to be Cecil's Restaurant, one of the many businesses that have closed around the Garberville-Redway area in recent years. The town hall was organized by 2nd District Supervisor Michelle Bushnell and drew a crowd of community members that included cannabis industry survivors, child care providers, teachers, and more. The town hall lasted 2 hours, where Rogers answered questions about concerns within the 2nd District, a district that spans Sonoma, Del Norte, Mendocino, Humboldt, and Trinity counties. Topics included in the discussion ranged from PG&E capacity failures and a lack of EV charging infrastructure in southern Humboldt, state forestry and biomass bills, U.S. Forest Service consolidation and what it means for Trinity County specifically, Rogers Bill AB 1984, which targets unlimited corporate election spending, the California governor's race, broadband construction along Highway 101, fire insurance reform, child care funding, and California's structural tax problems.
Every community is different, but the only thing that all five counties tend to agree on is that the state of California doesn't pay enough attention to it and doesn't understand rural communities. So I really see my job as helping to facilitate what we need at the ground level, especially in rural areas and in underserved areas, to make sure that one-size-fits-all approaches to policy that are being pushed by LA or Sacramento or San Francisco doesn't have unintended consequences for us, and to make sure that we get our fair share of resources as well. But the flip side of that is, with a district that's this big, I don't get to be an expert in almost any of the communities that I help represent, which is why these town halls are so important to us and the partnerships that we build with our local elected officials are so important as well.
One of the primary issues discussed at length was health care, ranging from Medicare cuts that were made on the bill H.R. 1 that was signed into law July 4th of last year, to legislation he introduced to recreate the Health Professional Shortage Areas federal program on the state level.
This is H.R. 1 and the cuts to health care is, for me, the biggest crisis that the state's going to face.
Yeah.
And it's going to be multi-front. Right? It's not going to be one specific thing. First and foremost, the reimbursement rate for the local hospital needs to change. Otherwise, they're going to be spending more money for the services that they're delivering than they actually get reimbursed for. That's one thing right off the top.
Yeah.
Second, you have this issue around re-enrollment that is now required for folks who are on Medi-Cal, that rather than re-enrolling once a year to make sure that the person is enrolled and is eligible, now the federal government has decided that there's so much fraud that they can't point to that we have to do it every 6 months. And what that means is that then the county, who is already strapped for resources and for health professionals, they have to have more people who do the re-enrollment. And it takes about 3 months for them to re-enroll people. So they'll get re-enrolled, they'll be on for 3 months, then they have to get re-enrolled again. It is going to have a significant financial burden to the county to implement, but also as people fall off the rolls and are no longer actually in Medi-Cal, that's fewer people who are using the hospital and using the health resources as preventative medicine. And whether you have your own private insurance, whether you stay enrolled in Medi-Cal, if you have fewer rate payers that you are being reimbursed from in the hospital that are accessing those services, there's an impact on everybody's access to healthcare, right? I always tell people representing this district, having health insurance is not the same thing as having health access. And if you have hospitals, clinics that really struggle with what services they can provide, then that's gonna impact everybody. And then from a practical perspective, you're gonna have folks who are not gonna be re-enrolled in Medi-Cal who are still going to show up at the emergency room. And there still is an obligation to serve those folks. And there's no reimbursement on that health triage that happens, right? Especially when folks then are dispersed out to other areas for care, those other areas where they actually land can do the reimbursement, but the emergency room itself that does that outpatient work doesn't get re-enrolled or doesn't get that reimbursement.
In southern Humboldt, there are two main hubs for medical care: Soham Health, which operates the Gerald Phelps Community Center in Garberville, and Redwoods Rural Health Center in Redway. Soham Health is currently in the middle of a major project to build a new hospital, as the current building cannot meet the state's upcoming seismic requirements. Due to this, the building must be replaced or lose its hospital license by 2030. The planned new facility, which will be a two-story hospital and clinic at its Sprowls Creek Road location, is estimated at $75 million, with construction slated to begin in 2027. The facility is expected to open to patients by 2030 and depends on a federal USDA rural development loan and community fundraising. Both organizations depend heavily on Medi-Cal reimbursements, and while there was a $50 billion Rural Health Transformation Fund included in the H.R. 1 bill as a counterweight to cuts, according to Georgetown University's Center for Children and Families, the fund covers only about one-third of the $137 billion in projected Medicaid cuts to rural areas, and only runs for 5 years despite the cuts being permanent, then was restricted by federal regulators so that no more than 15% of funds go directly to health providers. He additionally mentioned the recent legislation where the governor reclassified mobile health services from a required program to an optional one for counties, which for a county like Humboldt often means unfunded rather than optional.
So the final one that I'll mention, that this is self-inflicted from the state, and I'm working on this. We have written a letter to the governor. We're going to push on this in the budget. Is the governor also decided this year to change for mobile health services to make it an optional program for counties, not a required program. That was his way of saving money. But from a practical standpoint, what that means is for counties like Humboldt, if it's optional, they don't get reimbursed for it. So they're not going to do it, or they're not going to be able to figure out how to do it. I shouldn't say you're not going to be able to, because I know that it's something that the county is very dedicated to and has stood up a system to try to work. So we're pushing on the governor to make sure that in the budget, it's changed back from being an optional to a required, because that's what our community is going to need to benefit. One of the bills that I'm working on this year is called HPSA's Health Professional Shortage Areas. Spoiler, we qualify in Garberville. But that was a federal program that recognized areas that had mental health, physical health, and dental health shortages and provided a premium to bring those specialists or bring those professionals to the area. HR 1 eliminated that, and so we have a bill this year to reinstate that at the state level and create a state program so that underserved areas have some ability to compete to bring those professionals to it as well.
Rogers stated plans to return to the area roughly every 3 weeks, and residents can reach his district office through Rogers' field representative, Haiti McHugh, or through Rogers' office website at rogers.asmdc.org. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.
And now, a public news story from Suzanne Potter, focusing on Trump pulling funding for small farmers.
The Trump administration recently pulled funding for 49 programs designed to help small farmers acquire land and get started, including five in California. Community projects funded by the Increasing Land Capital and Market Access Program came to a halt in the Bay Area, the Central Coast, Fresno, Santa Ana, and San Diego. The $300 million program directed aid to underserved farmers, many in rural areas. Colleen Hotchkiss with the Alameda County Resource Conservation District says the abrupt termination letter laid out the administration's reasons.
Our intention to prioritize underserved producers did not align with the USDA's current priorities of unity, equality, meritocracy, and colorblindness.
The termination letter also claimed many of the programs distributed too little aid to farmers. Hotchkiss says the program in Alameda County had only spent $30,000 out of the $480,000 grant because the feds froze funds and slow-walked approvals. She adds her agency was forced to cancel one program to lease city-owned properties in Oakland and Hayward to small producers and another that provides micro-grants.
Mini-grants of even $2,000 to $3,000 are very impactful for small farms that have difficulty accessing traditional funding like Farm Service Agency loans and things like that.
The feds tried to terminate the same grant last year to one other program in California, a small nonprofit farming collective based in El Sobrante called Agroecology Commons. But the collective sued, so the contract is technically still in place while the litigation plays out. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Up next is the National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld the Indian Child Welfare Act in 2023, according to reporting by SCOTUS blog, affirming the law's role in keeping Native children connected to their families and tribes. But nearly 2 years later, implementation challenges remain. Legal analysis from Cornell Law School says states are still working to fully carry out ICWA's requirements, and according to the National Indian Child Welfare Association, tribal leaders say the law is critical to protecting Native children and preserving cultural identity, and are calling for stronger enforcement nationwide. In the U.S. Supreme Court showdown over the 14th Amendment last week, justices sharply questioned the Trump administration's lawyer for invoking Native American history to challenge the birthright citizenship of immigrants. KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports on why his arguments faced resistance.
In defending President Trump's executive order against birthright citizenship, Solicitor John Sauer compared Indian tribes to foreign governments. He argued the U.S. Constitution treats tribes as sovereign nations, and that when the country was founded, tribal members and their children were not considered citizens, much like the children of foreign diplomats, a standard that he says should be applied to immigrants.
You're using some pretty obscure sources to get to this concept.
Justice Sonia Sotomayor challenged Sauer's reasoning.
The Indian tribes were analogize to foreign diplomats. So what do we do with that?
I'd say two things. First, as the Indian tribes, we think that's a case that strongly supports us.
But Bob Anderson, an Indian law professor at Harvard, says that comparison just doesn't hold.
And they were really stretching to make it apply, and I think they failed.
Anderson says those doubts raised about Sauer's case appear to cut across ideological lines.
It seemed to me that the conservative members of the court recognized that. I was surprised that they seemed to be so much in alignment with the opponents of the Trump administration.
Justice Neil Gorsuch, a widely regarded expert on Indian law, pressed Sauer on Native American citizenship.
Do you think they're birthright citizens?
No, I think the clear understanding that everybody agrees in the congressional debates is that the children of tribal Indians are not birthright citizens.
I understand that's what they said.
Justice Gorsuch eventually got Sauer to agree that by today's standards, tribal Indians are birthright citizens. But then Sauer walked that back.
Not sure. I have to think that through.
So based on the Trump solicitor's arguments, should Native Americans worry about their citizenship status? Anderson says,
no, there's no way that this case could affect the citizenship of Indian tribes because Congress passed a separate law in 1924, automatically making all tribal members in the United States citizens.
The 1924 law passed decades after the 14th Amendment to close the loophole that had left Native Americans without automatic citizenship. The law, though, did not affect their tribal government-to-government status under the Constitution. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Leaders from tribal colleges and universities are calling on Congress to increase federal funding, saying current support falls short of what's needed. The American Indian Higher Education Consortium says tribal colleges receive significantly less funding per student than other public institutions, despite serving communities with higher financial need. AIHEC President and CEO Onawake Rowe says, quote, a flourishing tribal higher education sector strengthens the entire nation. Leaders are urging lawmakers to fully fund tribal college programs, saying the federal government has a trust responsibility to support Native education. I'm Jill Freitas.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Gathering of Nations Powwow. The Last Dance is this April 24th and 25th at Expo New Mexico. See the outgoing of current Miss Indian World, Dania Wawasuk, Saturday, April 25th. Tickets at gatheringofnations.com and at the gates. Tribal Development Partners believe strong infrastructure strengthens tribal sovereignty. Through the 105L lease program, TDP helps align federal funding systems with long-term tribal priorities. More at tribaldevpartners.com. Proud to support this show.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Finally, we have a press release from the Yurok tribe. As part of a new agreement between the two Northern California tribes, the Yurok Fire Department recently started overseeing Blue Lake Rancheria's fire management operations, as well as providing expertise and assistance for cultural burning initiatives. Signed by Yurok Chairman Joseph L. James and Blue Lake Chairman Jason Ramos, the Memorandum of Understanding will improve the rancheria's capacity to prepare for, respond to, and recover from wild land fires. Quote, the Yurok tribe has been a valued member and brings significant expertise in wild land fire management, said Jason Ramos, the Blue Lake Rancheria tribal chairman. We are pleased to see tribes collaborating in this critically important area, an effort that will benefit our local communities. Quote, we are always happy to share our knowledge and expertise with fellow tribes, said Joseph L. James, the Yurok tribal chairman. I'd like to sincerely thank the Blue Lake Rancheria for selecting the Yurok Fire Department. This partnership will strengthen tribal sovereignty, self-determination, and safety within our respective communities. We are grateful for the opportunity to provide these services and help out a neighboring tribal fire department, added Yurok Fire Chief Rod Mendez. Quote, this agreement represents a win-win for the tribes and surrounding communities, end quote. Per the agreement, the Yurok Fire Department will provide oversight and operational management of Blue Lake Rancheria's fire personnel and equipment, utilize the Blue Lake Rancheria's fire department as a satellite facility, and provide administrative assistance as needed. The agreement also funds a new battalion chief position for Yurok Fire, who will be stationed in the Blue Lake Rancheria facility. The Yurok tribe will also assist with cultural fire practices, including help and training from Yurok prescribed fire burn bosses and other fire practitioners. Blue Lake Rancheria will designate its own teams of cultural fire practitioners and develop cultural fire objects and operations. Cultural burning is a practice that leads to a healthier ecosystem for all plants and animals, long-term fire protection for residents, and supports the traditional hunting and gathering activities of Native people. The tribes have held successful collaborative burn demonstrations in the last 3 years on Blue Lake Rancheria property as part of the annual Cultural Burn Seminar. The Yurok Fire Department is an all-risk, all-hazard organization that focuses on fire detection, prevention, and suppression in conjunction with traditional and conventional fuels management. The Chartered Tribal Agency fights wildfires in the local area and across the U.S. as a national resource. In addition to extinguishing fires, the Yurok crew conducts cultural burns to moderate forest fuel loads, improve wildlife habitat, and increase access to traditional basket weaving materials and indigenous foods on tribal lands. When they are not contending with fires or performing controlled burns, the Yurok crew works on projects that reduce fire risk on the reservation. Chief Mendez has more than 35 years of fire officer leadership experience, including lengthy terms as a district fire management officer for the Klamath National Forest, and as the chief of fire and office of emergency services for the Hoopoe Valley Tribe. That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Katie Phillips, and thanks to our reporter, Nat Cardos. KMOD News is online. You can find us on KMOD.org and now streaming on podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media, including Facebook and Instagram. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. I'd also like to remind folks before the end of our broadcast that our spring membership drive is April 13th to the 22nd. Please get in touch with us at 707-923-3911. That number again is 707-923-3911 or kmud.org and click on the donate button. Your donations help keep our local news on the air. Redwood Community Radio Incorporated is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm April Lewis. Stay tuned in.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.